Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else, close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And you notice I said that all without my tongue leaving my mouth.
I hope so. I actually didn't look, so hopefully your tongue stayed in your mouth the whole time.
Yes, and my wrists and my hands have never left my wrists in this entire process.
That's truly fantastic. I think that has set the listening audience at ease.
Yes, and the economy is roaring back.
Roaring back. This is a new
form. That was the headline.
This is a new form of doing the limbo.
Yeah. So there is some other good news out there, I think. I like good news.
Good news is good by definition.
The research and development spending is up in this quarter compared with what it's done.
That's fantastic news.
And there's a reason for that. Now, business investment is starting to come up. People are buying. They're not buying a lot of new equipment, but they are hiring people, and they are adding inventory, which is very positive. And the reason it's positive is business owners and people who make the decisions about these things have historically had a better feel for where things are going in the next year or so than anybody else, because they're looking at their they're listening to their customers, they're having orders come in that are long-term orders, and when you see really long-term investing by businesses, which is R&D, research and development spending,
that's going up,
which is crucial to us staying in business. And when you see inventories being built, is what they were doing is they were trimming inventories during all the previous 2016 quarters. Businesses have been selling more than they're buying, which means they anticipate a recession coming in the not too far distant future. In other words, they anticipate a slowdown in people buying things. Now, they've reversed that in the third quarter and started buying more stuff than they're selling, which means they anticipate an increase in consumer activity going forward. And it's based on the people who make these decisions actually talking to their customers. And as they talk to their customers, they're finding out that people are planning on buying things. Now, that's backed up by something else. The durable goods sales and orders were one of the real bright spots that caused that 2.9% growth. Now, what does that mean?
It means people are buying things that they expect to last.
Yes.
New washing machines, mm-hmm. refrigerators, sometimes cars. And this is really good stuff.
Interesting thing about durable goods, the vast majority of durable goods purchased in the United States are purchased on credit. That means that, and they typically pay them off over 3 years, 3 to 5 years. Cars are an example of a durable good, and they pay it off over 5 years. That means that there are an increasing number of consumers in the United States who believe that over the next 3 to 5 years, their jobs are secure and the economy is going to do pretty good. And by the way, the fact that they believe it will tend to make it happen under most circumstances, because that means they will spend more money, which will make the economy better.
And this is a really, really important piece of news. Durable goods being up, research and development going up, excuse me. I mentioned last hour that consumer confidence didn't rise as fast this last mm-hmm. month as it has before. It was still up.
I think it was actually down a little bit, but you may be right.
There's two numbers that get reported. The one number is, how do you feel about the economy?
Right.
That's up. The other number is, how do you feel about everybody else in the economy? How do you feel? What do you think is happening to everyone else? That number's down. People feel like in their own households, they're doing better, and they expect that to continue. But they hear so much bad news that they think everybody else must be different than them. Everybody else must be in a bad state. So the consumer confidence mm-hmm. about everybody else is down. Well, that doesn't really jibe up. It means that there's another dichotomy there, that they think that they are different than everyone else, when what we're seeing in the economy is really good news for the vast majority of the United States.
I have gradually come to see the consumer confidence numbers as being contraindicators, meaning that the lower they go, the better things are going to be, and the higher they go, the worse things are going to be.
Except for the number that says, how are things with you right now?
Yeah.
That's a really accurate one, but that's not the one they talk about going up and down. The headline one is always, how do you feel about everybody else? Yeah. This is really vital, because when we're talking about long-term expenditures, you don't buy a new car unless you're confident that you're going to be able to pay for it. You don't buy a new washing machine unless you're confident you'll be able to pay for it. Over the years since the Great Recession, a lot of people put off buying new washing machines, buying new cars, because they needed to save up for it. They were not ready to get back into debt. So that confidence level is the same when we look at businesses doing research and development as it is with durable good orders in your house. If, I mean, I'm driving down the streets and seeing boxes for 42-inch TVs on the side of the road being waiting to be picked up. I mean, when was the last time in your lifetime 42-inch TVs were a normal purchase? So the standard of living is up as well.
Yeah, and there's exceptions to this. And it's important to realize that the consumer confidence is shown by making long-term leveraged purchases, the real consumer conference, the in other words, the buying of houses, the buying of cars, the buying of washing machines and televisions. This is a real positive positive thing in the economy, with one exception, and you have to really go back and look at something else to figure out whether we're in trouble or not. We had really, 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 really high, that's big league.
Big league, he clarified that.
Big league, big
yes,
league.
He says big league, not
big, big league. Okay, big league consumer confidence.
That was major news this morning. He clarified that he's saying big league, not big league.
And everybody thought it was big league.
Not everyone, because the experts were going in and listening to the sounds over and over again, and they did hear a G in there.
Okay, that's perfectly right. So big league, we'll use that. That's a new word, big league, one word. Consumer confidence in late 1999 and 2000, and again in 2007. Now, what's the difference between high, and I say high consumer confidence, both the consumer confidence reports and the behavior indicated people thought things were going to be great into the future. If savings rates are low and the cash reserves across the country are low and people are really wild-eyed, optimistic about the future, we're in for a crash.
Yeah, we've got high savings rate historically. Mm-hmm. We've got people that are cautiously optimistic about the future, yeah, and not optimistic about the people around them, just for themselves.
And what right now we have a high savings rate. We have, as a matter of fact, three articles that I read, and I don't know the numbers myself, and the numbers can be interpreted differently, but we have something approaching the highest level of cash.
Right.
When we combine corporations and investors and individuals in the United States, we have the highest as a percentage of what's out there, the highest levels of cash we have seen since they've been keeping records on this.
So this, again, comes to what I said last hour. I'm going to preface this to begin with. The two of us in here try to stay non-political.
It's called apolitical.
Apolitical.
Which is supposed to be political.
We look at it and we say, whomever is elected, if we have a Trump as a president or a Clinton as a president, they will be our president. We're very clear on that. And we will deal with that situation, whichever one, as it arises, and give respect to the office. That's something that everybody has to understand when we're talking about this. When we're looking at these numbers, it is a very high likelihood with that amount of cash, and the reason why people say they have that amount of cash in businesses and in their households is because they're nervous as to what is going to happen in the election. Once the election happens, no matter which way it goes, that reason for waiting goes away with it.
Probably.
Probably. Which gives them the ability to do the investment that they wanted. They at least get to settle on one candidate or the other. Both candidates are not popular. That's one of the things that people that are very for Hillary Clinton can't understand, that she's not popular. People that are very, very for Donald Trump can't understand that he's not popular, that the majority of the United States doesn't really like either one of the candidates. Once we know who's going to be president, we can start making decisions. The entire country is waiting with bated breath, and they're holding off on major short-term purchases. They're still making the long-term ones.
And for whatever it's worth, I'm going to make a call here. I've done it before.
You're going to call?
Back in 2009, I said, I think this is the bottom of the market. I think we're in for a major bull market. I actually said on Bloomberg TV in 2002, this is the bottom. We're in for a major bull market over the next several years. And the guy said, what if it's different this time? And I said, that's proof, because you just said, what if it's different this time?
Yeah.
It's never different this time. If we look at the things that indicate a growing economy and a market that's growing faster than normal over the next several years, they're just about 80 or 90% of them are in place right now. Why do I say that? Because we look at the, you know, a lot of people are saying the market's too high. Well, this is my response to that very simply. Microsoft, which is one of the larger elements in the S&P 500 and I think it's in the Dow, is finally back to the same price it was in 2000. Now, the price-to-earnings ratio back then was 45, and the price-to-earnings ratio today is something low.
Yeah, but they've just come out with a whole bunch of new products actually knocking the tar out of everybody in their class.
So this is the point. What we have had is 16 years of lousy, subpar market performance. Anytime we go back in history and find 16 years of lousy, subpar market performance, the next decade is exceptionally good.
Yeah, if you look, the last time it happened was the end of the 60s going all the way through the 70s and to the beginning of the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a big, long stretch of subpar performance right before the 80s boom. And that led to an 80s boom and a 90s boom.
So we get these what are called secular bull markets and secular bear markets. We have been in a secular bear market since 2000. And this is about how long they generally run. Now, there's a second issue, and I mentioned this earlier in last hour, but I want to say it again. The extremely slow growth that we have seen since the Great Recession of 2008, 2009, has not overtaxed the economy. We get recessions when we get economic recessions. They're called supply recessions.
Right.
When we overdo it, and we've overdone it, and we made the assumption that things are going to be better, and so people overspend, and businesses oversupply.
Let me give this an example, and we were using property last hour, so this is a good one. If there are not enough houses, right now we're in that.
Yeah, we are in that position.
We don't have enough houses to go around. People are buying houses, so the prices are up. And one of the things that is interesting to note is that the prices on houses are at a 0.2% less than they were at the peak at the end of 2006.
Right.
So the housing market has almost completely recovered. Mm-hmm. We don't have enough houses to go around because construction jobs disappeared during the recession at a much higher rate. We're getting them back. They're coming back in droves, and we're using new equipment and better tools to do it. Because
we're improving productivity.
Right. Productivity is going up in construction at a very high rate. That's a lot of the productivity growth that we see comes out of that area. What tends to happen, though, right now we're at the beginning of this. There's a lot of pent-up demand and not a lot of supply. And this is a really good industry to talk about because it's so common for this to happen. Construction businesses tend to get into it, build, get good profits, causing other construction businesses to get into it, build, get great profits, causing more to come in, and then eventually they build way too many houses. That's oversupply.
Because that's what builders do. They build.
They build, and they don't know how to not build. If they're in business, they're going to be building. If it's going into spec homes because people aren't buying them right now, that's a very normal practice at the end of the boom, and that causes the bust. If you apply that across the board to the whole economy, not just to construction, and you think of inventory in the same way, we tend to do that, and that's a precursor to a recession when you have a lot of inventory built up and a lower demand than usual. We have the opposite of that right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of inventory in most areas. And there's a pent-up demand in a lot of those areas. So what we're seeing about durable goods and the new housing starts, all of that is the same growth push.
Yes. Okay.
I took it in the middle of one of your sentences, and I wanted to hand it back. I'm sorry about that.
The issue is that most recessions and expansions in the history of our economy have been inventory related. Now, by inventory related, meaning businesses build up too much inventory. They anticipate things will be a lot better because they have been a lot better. And so they get ahead of the power curve and they buy a bunch of stuff. And then people run out of money. They run out of credit. They run out of everything. They suddenly stop spending. The businesses are left with a bunch of stuff, and they start hiring off, they start laying off people.
Because they spent too much of their investment on long-term items.
And they have fewer customers coming in, so they start laying off people, which results in even less buying, which means more people get laid off, and eventually we hit a bottom, and then that turns around and comes back up. That's the standard cycle, business cycle in the economy. Now, the one that we had in 2008 and 2009, the Great Recession.
Not standard.
Was a financial recession. Now, the
pent-up demand was there, the supply was still low, but the access to the normal way of getting money disappeared.
We over-leveraged, and we over-leveraged primarily in one area, but it rippled into the rest of the economy. And the banks stopped lending, and a whole lot of things stopped happening. But this is the point. Historically, that type of recession results on the backside in very low growth and a very long expansion, which towards the end tends to pick up and get back into normal growth rates. But, and I think that's pretty much where we are right now. We do not see any evidence of a standard recession building up, frankly, because business inventories are very, very low. Now, there's exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
The automobile industry is probably about to get in a hurt because they have built more SUVs than people are willing to buy. And that's, in a sense, their own fault because they have built them to last a long time.
Well, there's another aspect of that, too. And this is one we touched on a little bit earlier. Millennials, by and large, take the ecology of the world very seriously. And just because the price of oil comes down and the price of gas comes down, in prior generations, we would say, all right, let's go back to big cars. Millennials are not doing that. They're not doing it at the rate that we did as, you know, I'm an Xer, you're
right.
A boomer.
Right.
They're looking at this at a completely non-market-oriented way when it comes to the other eco besides economics. When they're looking at the eco of the world.
The ecology.
Yeah, the ecology. They're seeing a threat that is very real to them. And when I say to them, it's a threat that it's really hard to ignore. If you just have to ignore data to ignore that threat.
We probably ought to break for commercials.
Well, we can't do it right now.
Okay.
Because there's going to be Fox News.
Okay.
And there's a bug in the system right now. So we'll.
Is that anything to do with the spec houses?
I think there was a bug in the spec house system. Yes.
So it has something to do with fly specs?
Fly specs.
Okay,
could be.
Anyway.
Yes, or the paper.
Okay, well, since we're not going to talk about that.
Or ointment.
I'd like to change the subject for a moment.
Let's do that.
Okay, there's some really good studies, big league studies.
Big league studies.
Right, that came out over the last several months about immigration. And there's a couple of news points, a couple of factoids there that are pretty important. There are four nations in the world.
Only four?
To which high-skilled, intelligent people are migrating. It is in reverse order of importance. Let's see if I can get them all here. Australia, Great Britain, Canada, and the United States. The United States is getting far more high-skilled, highly educated immigrants than any other nation in the world. And it's one of the main reasons, and I'm not setting this, this is serious, one of the main reasons our economy is growing faster than any other economy in the world. And I realize some people are saying, well, China's growing fast and India's growing fast. Yeah, but they're starting from so far behind that it doesn't even really count. You know, like if you have $1 and you have two, you had 100% growth in 1 year, and therefore you're the smartest investor in the world. No, you're just still poor.
Still only have $2.
The issue is that our culture is, you're going to find this hard to believe, probably the most welcoming of other cultures and other people in the world.
I don't think that's hard to believe. I mean, we know we're the melting pot. That's what we are.
But, you know, right now, there's a lot of xenophobia and hostility to people coming in from other cultures. Now, this is the funny thing about this. It's not just the high-skilled people that are building our economy. It's the people who immigrated 10 years ago who have settled in and are working and are making a living and starting to buy things. That is a big chunk of the growth in our economy. Now, why is that important? They're also having a lot of kids. If you eliminate immigration, let's just simply, or even if you cut immigration in half in the United States over the last 10 years, legal and illegal, and this is what the studies all confirmed, the economy of the United States would look like the economy of Europe trying to figure out whether we're going to go into a recession or a depression. And the reason is really obvious in the numbers. You look who's paying the taxes, you look who's doing the work, you look who is buying things, and lo and behold, immigrants are buying more things, paying more taxes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because they are starting, kind of like the third world countries we're talking about, they're starting from a low position. They see other people around them better off. They have an opportunity. They work really, 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 really hard, and they're trying to build something for their children, and they generally have a lot of children. The native-born population in the United States is not having enough babies to replace our population. One of the biggest economic hurdles that Europe and Japan have to face that they have not addressed,
shrinking populations,
is an aging, shrinking population. And one of the reasons our recovery has been unusually slow, one of the reasons that our economy is not taking off like gangbusters right now, is we have a big chunk of our population retiring. We don't produce things. It's retired. Most retired people don't produce things anymore. They just draw on what everybody else is doing.
Right.
And as a result of that, it doesn't mean it's not a negative to the economy, but it's definitely a damper on the economy because these people are earning money without working. And, you know, they're getting paid, but they're not actually adding anything. Yeah, they have in the past added to the growth of the economy, and they have paid their way in. I'm not negating that in any way, as particularly considering my age and the fact that I draw Social Security, although I'm still employed. But the point I want to make is,
I think you're
immigration
materially unemployed.
Okay, well,
because you are working for yourself as an MI.
Yeah, well, I generate GDP, lots of
right,
it.
Right. There you
and
go.
And I employ people, so that's what counts. Hey, the point I want to make is, when we think about immigration, these studies have shown that the immigration rates in the United States are vital to us continuing to grow as a nation. If we were to do as Japan has done and pretty much seal ourselves off from immigration from lower economic areas, we would in fact cripple ourselves in very short order and doom ourselves in about 20 years to sinking into a permanent recession like we see going on in Japan.
Or in Southern Europe.
Right. And so this is one of those things we need to keep in mind. There is one sector of the population that all the studies identify as being damaged by high levels of immigration. And you probably won't be too surprised to find out. High school dropouts have their income and financial security damaged by high levels of low-skill immigration because they're in competition. Everybody
right.
else gets a boost. Now, high school educated people are also at risk if their high school education really didn't take.
Right.
And I actually know somebody who is my model for this, and his ability to construct a sentence in print, even though he is a superbly skilled craftsman.
Right.
In the area of welding, his ability to construct a coherent sentence in print is extremely limited. Well, if somebody immigrates in from Mexico that is also a good welder but can't construct a sentence in English in print,
they're in direct competition.
And they're willing to work for less money than he is. So he is upset about that, and he is angry about it, and I can really understand that.
Yeah. And if you're a welder and you're listening to this, I can almost guarantee you it's not you.
No, he lives a long ways from here.
Right.
And I'm quite confident he does not listen to our radio program.
Right. I believe that he would make it through about half a minute before turning it off.
Yeah, it's probably where he is.
But we have a great deal of love and respect for that guy.
Yeah, we do. And that's one of the things we understand and I realize, and it makes us enemies on both sides, is I really understand the appeal of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And I really understand the appeal of Hillary Clinton.
Yep. Both sides.
And I also understand the disgust with Donald Trump and the disgust with Hillary Clinton. And I happen to know, and I happen to believe right now, I think we both agree on this, that the disgust levels are higher than the appeal levels
right.
in both cases.
And neither of them have anywhere near a majority approval.
Right.
If I mean, right now, if you look at the approval ratings for Obama, who has not had some great approval ratings lately.
It's like 52%.
Yeah, he's way up in the majority again. He's, you know, I think it's getting closer to the 54%
wow.
mark, because just in comparison to the rolling in the mud that's happening in the political world, it looks like he is clean.
Actually, the only person that I've been able to identify in the public eye who is would actually get a landslide for president right now is Michelle Obama. She has a 60% approval rating.
Right. Well, I mean, Paul Ryan, if he were running for president, might win, but not against Michelle Obama.
Well, actually, his popularity among Republicans has fallen off dramatically recently, so he might not even win.
Who knows? I mean, the reality here, and this is the theme that both old Baldy and young Baldy agree with, is that we're Americans. And if we have a threat from outside, I expect that the people I would want to be on my side are the radical right and the radical left, because they become the most radical in defending who we are. Let's not forget that going forward. Let's not forget left and right, that we've got to be together for the rest of our lives.
Let me give you some information, folks, that you can use in your planning for the next year.
Oh, is it a calendar?
Calendar
would be
no,
nice.
No, it's better than that.
Is it a Tuesday or
if
Wednesday?
If you were
on the
thinking 28th? About taking a vacation to Canada or Europe, from a financial perspective, this is a really, really good time. You right now,
right.
The it takes $1.33 of Canadian dollar to buy $1 U.S.
Just a few years ago, it was dollar for dollar par.
Mm-hmm. And so when you go, you get basically a very substantial discount, about a 40% discount on everything. You see something up there, and it's for $5. It basically, if you're using dollars to pay for it, American dollars, and you convert them, you get about a 40% discount on everything you buy up there.
That's pretty nice.
And their prices, this is the amazing thing. A meal, for example, in Canadian dollars costs about the same in Canadian dollars as it does in U.S. dollars. So you get a 40% discount on hotel rates, on everything else.
Right.
Europe is even better. The euro is just barely over a dollar now. It used to be $1.40. Which means that this is one of the best times.
Yeah,
things are cheap. It's a good time to go to Europe, and it's a good time to go to Canada on vacation. This summer would be even a better time because it's cooler there than it is here.
If the ratios stay the same, and
yes,
who knows?
Well,
things can change a lot from now until summer.
You're right. But we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. It's Chris, Georgetown.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Chris von Georgetown.
So if I'm going to Europe, it's going to be Belgium, so I can drink all the Belgian beer. That's where I'm going.
Just know that the Belgians are very strange.
They have Wallanders there.
Yeah. They can stop hold free trade agreements just in little provinces. So,
yes.
Yeah, Belgian beer, though, if you go to the Tapas Monk Monastery,
yes.
You will go with my prayers following you, because you may not return. You may decide to become a monk.
What I think is interesting, the real good beer, in Jeff McClure's humble opinion, having lived in Europe, is going from village to village in Bavaria. Every little village has its own brewery with its own 5,000-year-old recipe or something like that for beer, and every one of them tastes different. The problem is that at the end of the tour, go ahead and schedule yourself for a detox.
A new liver needs to be installed.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, my brother works for a company in Germany, and he brought a growler, and it was from a brewery in Nuremberg from 1040.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Like, right.
Holy moly. 1040?
They've spent a long time perfecting that recipe, let me tell you.
There's a brewery in Salado that I like a lot. It's Barrow Brewing.
It's from 2016, isn't it?
No, I think it was at 10:40 as well, to a.m. though.
Okay,
AM,
right.
Not A.D.
Georgetown has a brewery a mile from my house now.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome. Hey, I was going to ask you guys about, I understand the appeal of Donald Trump, and it's a funny appeal that people, he's just basically a guy that's, it's like having a lawyer. You hate lawyers, but you want the best lawyer, right? And he's kind of that guy that you hate him, but you want him on your side because he's going after the people you want him to go after.
You really don't want him not on your side, that's for sure.
And it is sort of like suing somebody, because what you're trying to do is tear something down. You think whatever we get, and this is kind of the philosophy, and I may be wrong, somebody can call and tell me, the philosophy of the people who support Donald Trump is things are so screwed up.
The system's broken.
That tearing it down and destroying it, whatever came back would be better than what we have now. Whereas the people who support Hillary Clinton think, okay, the system's pretty good, but it could be better, and we'd like to tweak it a little bit and make it better.
Right. And so from the Hillary Clinton perspective, it's kind of business as usual. From Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders' perspective, it's things are broken and we got to fix them, and that may mean we have to break it more before we fix it.
Well, actually, I think both of them say break everything and then whatever we build would be better.
Right, and that concept, both of them are extremely valid. But the really cool piece that I find here is that it's a reversal of the traditional conservative liberal going on, and that the liberal party, the Democrats, have a nominee that says we're going to keep things in the status quo.
Which is a conservative position.
Right, and we have a conservative nominee that says we need to change everything, and that's a very liberal perspective.
Yeah, and that's we're seeing a complete switch on the parties.
Well, I think so my point of view is that the reason Donald won, especially in the evangelical vote, that Ted Cruz you would think had won, is that a lot of the conservatives that are, they're conservative, they don't go to church all, this is my opinion, they don't go to church all the time, but they're kind of conservative, is that they've kind of had enough of voting for people that say, hey, listen, I'm a Christian conservative, I'm going to do these things for you. But then they go to Washington, D.C., and they just perpetuate a big government plan and don't really do what they should do. And so that's my opinion, is the reason people voted for Trump was, okay, look, we've had enough of you telling us that you are this, but then you don't do it. And so we're going to choose a guy.
You got a good point there.
Yeah, and just to hit that, to show you in clear writing, Donald Trump was saying the system's rigged. The first debate, he said he would absolutely stand by the election results. Then at his rallies, he was saying the system's rigged. There's things wrong with the system. I'm not sure if I trust it. He was asked at the third debate to say he would honor the election results. Now, that was a big thing. It hit the headlines, and everybody talked back and forth. I'm not talking about what he actually said here. I'm actually talking about the concept that we have taken for granted for many years, that politicians will say something to their base, and then when they get out on the main stage where everybody's listening, they change their words. He didn't change his words. Yeah. He kept saying the same thing he said to the base. Now, that is a symptom of one of the problems in Washington, in that we kind of expect the politicians to say one thing to us and say something else when they get to Washington, or something else when they get into the big public eye instead of just the base eye. And saying that says that there are issues that need to be resolved.
You know, one of the big issues, in Jeff McClure's opinion, is that the American voting populace is profoundly ignorant of how government works.
Yes.
In other words,
absolutely.
If we elect a president who says, the president says he's going to repeal laws, basically Donald Trump has promised to do things that are specifically forbidden by the Constitution. For example, discrimination.
He's got to work with Congress.
Well, not only Congress, but the Constitution specifically forbids a lot of the things that he says he wants to do. Now, people want to do that. They want to, for instance, the idea of, and he's backed off from this now, but the idea of saying no Muslims come into the United States. Well, that's specifically prohibited in the Constitution, and the Supreme Court would throw it out if he tried to do it, and Congress would never support him in trying to do it. So politicians make promises to do things that either they, in his case it may be true, that he doesn't know that he can't do that. But in other cases, congressmen are probably quite aware
that they can't do the things they promise.
If let's say John Carter runs it, he says, and he has said, I'm going to cut the budget. I hate to tell you this, guy, but there's like 438 people involved here and you're only one. You're not going to cut the budget. As a matter of fact,
it takes a lot of people to cut that budget.
And when he gets there, in fact, what he's going to do, and you can depend on this no matter who gets elected, is he is going to vote for and push for federal dollars to come to his district, which is the opposite of cutting the budget. Now, does that mean he's evil? No. It does mean after he's been there a few years, he's going to get a little cynical because he realizes he has to come back and promise to do something that is factually impossible in order to get reelected. But this isn't his fault. This is our fault.
Yeah, electorate's fault.
We ask our Congress members and the president, we expect them and support them when they promise to do things that cannot be done.
Well, it's kind of like people that are conservative that take Social Security, right? They bitch and complain that they're you know, no, they're evil, I don't like socialism, but then I say, you take Social Security,
oh, yeah,
right? Well, okay, please don't, you're taking Social Security, so please don't tell me you don't like socialism because you're taking Social Security. Oh, and then now you're old enough that you take Medicare?
Yeah, and they don't believe in a centralized single-payer system, but they're on one and they love it, and you try to take it away from them and they'll scream.
Right. And I made my point one time to another talk show host saying that, you know, he was talking about Obamacare and how evil it is. I said, what about, you know, Medicare D where you got the prescriptions? And he was saying, well, that's okay because my mother's on it. I'm like, what is the difference between Medicare D and Obamacare? There's no difference. You're doing the same thing.
Only there's a single payer there, yeah.
Yeah, and this
right.
is
so,
this is you're absolutely correct. What, as a matter of fact, I asked Lynn Woolley this very specifically one time. You know, if you're against socialism, does that mean you're against Social Security? Because that is the single most socialist aspect to our entire economy.
Yep.
And he danced around that one really, really hard because obviously he's trying to get ratings just like politicians are trying to get votes. If you're going to be against socialism, you should really vote libertarian and you should really run out there and support the libertarian cause that will – and last I looked, I haven't looked this year, they wanted to do away with Social Security and Medicare.
No, they haven't been very loud about that this year because they feel like they can get further by just being quiet for a little bit and letting the other candidates run themselves down.
Libertarianism says that Social Security and Medicare are the federal government doing something that it shouldn't do. It should confine itself to defense and enforcement of the law and just a few other things and shrink the federal government and stop giving people money who are old. And it would balance the budget out and kill the deficit in a moment if we could cut both of those.
Yeah, there may be a bit problem of popularity of.
Yeah, I don't think
nobody
would
get reelected.
Right. Hey, so this is also a business question, and this has to do with my business, and I'm in the food business. Distribution. Where do you see distribution going in the future? Like, because Dallas is a massive distribution center and stuff like that, and where do you see it going in moving towards non-human I don't know if it's like non-humans doing it
Yep.
Google this week just had its first delivery in a non-drivered truck. 50,000 cans of Budweiser were delivered.
Ooh, very appropriate.
Right, it's a great delivery method in that the truck doesn't care where it's loaded or unloaded. The truck drove.
Right.
And there were no people involved. So distribution becomes a lot easier when the robots do it. You don't have to have a population center be a distribution center anymore.
Walmart's almost already, you notice where the big Walmart distribution centers are, and it's not around population centers.
It used to be you needed to have a lot of people in there to work it. And the Amazon distribution centers are using less and less people. That means that the big facilities, if they were industrial or materials-oriented, don't have to be at the population centers anymore, and that's a shift. That's a big shift.
If you're in a job that does not require high-level communication skills and high-level literacy and critical thinking, your job is threatened.
Right, right. No, okay, I agree. That's kind of weird. I'm in the consulting business for food, but you still – it's kind of a weird – we're still in we still have to have the people right now to do certain things, but it's taking less and less people to do certain things. And that's just the way it's moving. Because, my company, I work for, is a shared resource. And people are simply, they're starting companies and they're like, I can't afford to hire a whole bunch of people to do these things, but I can hire people that are really good at one specific job to help a whole bunch of people out, whether it's distribution, whether it's technology, or something like that.
I don't want to interrupt you, but I got to. We got to do commercials.
Have a good weekend, guys.
Talk Thanks for the call. Take care, sir.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure, where Jeff knows how to use his radio voice.
Yes, sort of.
Well,
we all know how to use our voices, sort
of. Practiced since 1966. I started practicing my radio voice in 1966.
Did you use one when you were a child at all?
No, I did not use one when I was a child. But I now know how to use a radio voice.
Who were some of the other well-known DJs of 1966?
I have not a clue in the world.
Was there a wolf involved in 1966?
Oh, yeah. Wolfman Jack.
Right.
I used to listen to Wolfman Jack in the 1960s. Any of you have seen American Graffiti? That actually was Wolfman Jack. Recordings from Wolfman Jack that you heard on there. And we used to, on Saturday night, go out and park our cars in a circle as high school students. Actually, park our parents' cars in a circle and put the headlights in. And we did this on a runway in the local airport that was closed at night. I'm glad nobody tried to land. Everybody would turn on their radios, and we'd all tune to XERX out of Del Rio, Texas, which really was in Mexico, and we would listen to Wolfman Jack and dance, which was frowned upon by our parents.
Dancing is that could lead to other activities. You've
yes,
got to be careful with that.
When I was young, dancing was
the gateway action.
Well, it was considered. We had a pretty majority Baptist little town that I grew up in, and dancing was considered to be sinful. But since that was sinful, we also had alcoholic beverages being passed around in Coke bottles.
Ooh. Not that you're advocating underage drinking here.
Certainly not advocating underage drinking. I'm just saying that, and the other thing that went on is there was a tremendous number of cigarettes being smoked, and I was the nerd. I've always been a nerd, and I was the guy who, A, didn't get drunk, and B, didn't smoke cigarettes, and that way I could drive people home sometimes. That was my major role at the big dances, is to drive people home. But, you know, we all got to have our role.
You've been driving people crazy ever since.
Yes, that's
right.
What I do.
That's what we do.
I'm one of the economic drivers.
We drive craziness. Yes.
By the way, you know, we report on the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index like that's all there is to the market. It's not true. There's a lot more to the market than the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index. There's different aspects to it. There's different categories in it. And actually, some of them have underperformed the S&P 500, and some of them have overperformed the S&P 500. And one of the keys to investing is understanding over the long term that there are certain categories that outperform other categories. And I'll just leave it there, but that's what asset allocation is at least partially about, and I think that's important. Anyway, I just thought I'd say that.
There's been a big sell-off in the European bond market, which is a little bit unexpected. It's short-term sell-off, but something that we're looking at as the stability of Europe teeters with Britain leaving the Euro group, the European Union, as it's leaving. A lot of people are worried about its ability to pay its debts. So even with interest rates as low as they are, people are selling more, which means technically the interest rates are rising in a large portion of the European bonds right now. And that money that's being sold there is coming to the United States,
yeah,
quite often going into our bonds. We've seen last week we saw a dip in interest rates. This year, this week it's back up. But where did that come from? Why is it that we're seeing interest rates even lower and then coming back up to being slightly higher? It's just a very tiny movement. But we're seeing that because people think, even with the negativity that's going on out there, even with the one side saying, oh no, it's Hillary, the other side, oh no, it's Donald, America is still the safest place in the world. It's still the place where everybody wants to give their money.
It really boils down to the fact that we're in a global economy, whether we like it or not, and it's not going to change, no matter how much we wish we could go back to the 1950s or something. The reality is...
And the thing is, in the 1950s, it was the beginning of a global economy, but, that we were selling the rest of the world a lot of stuff, but the rest of the world had all of its stuff destroyed, so we had a big new market.
That's precisely what we wish we could go back to.
Right, and we can't do that unless the rest of the world is in not good shape.
Well, now, actually, we could. Arrange to get Russia, somehow manipulate Russia into invading Europe, and get into a war and smash Europe to smithereens, and then have them pay us to buy stuff to replace the stuff they got blown up. That worked really well, but... You know, across the board, there were just probably too many people who died when we did that, so we don't do that anymore. We're in a global economy, and interest rates in the United States are not controlled by the Federal Reserve, contrary to popular belief. Interest rates in the United States are controlled by the bond market, and the high-quality bond market in the United States, including the U.S. Treasury market, is heavily influenced by the number of people from outside the United States who want to buy U.S. Treasuries. One of the reasons our interest rates are so low across the board in the United States and our inflation is so low is because there's a lot of money from outside the United States flowing here, buying things, stabilizing things.
Not just money. People as well. And mm-hmm. You were talking about immigration. Right. I've spoken on it over the past several months about how we are a brain drain for the rest of the world. Well, you spoke about it earlier today, that we are the number one location that's sucking away really skilled, very intelligent people from the rest of the world. We're doing that, and we have to recognize the benefit, because if we turn our welcome lights off, when we pull out we take the welcome mat out from in front of the door, we start losing that. They'll keep them. It's important that they keep giving them to us, because we're the best place for the growth.
There's a really crucial thing to understand about the United States right now. The vast, vast majority of Nobel Prizes in technical areas...
Absolutely.
And international patents are occurring from the United States. Now, here's the second aspect of that that's so important. Half of those Nobel Prizes, actually about 80% of the Nobel Prizes issued to citizens of the United States or residents of the United States.
They're immigrants.
Are immigrants. Yeah. And when we come to the patents, if you look at the name on the patents, where we have the vast majority of new stuff that's being invented in the world, over half of those names are clearly not people who come from the traditional Anglo-Saxon background. Smart people are immigrating to the United States, where we have high property rights protection.
Right. And I spoke about this the week before your return. I spoke about it in great depth. I talked about we have 85 of the 100 top universities in the world. So the top 100 universities, we've got 85 of them. The other 15 are in the UK. That says something there. But when we talk about the K-12 education, K-12 is suffering. And we can read it writ large. Our graduate level and above at those same 85 colleges, we're at the 49% American in there. 51% immigrants in there, and that says we got to fix our K-12, but it also says we don't need to get rid of the smart immigrants that are coming here. We need to give them good compensation and make sure they stay.
Got it. And we're out of time.
We are. And if you would like to contact us off the air, we do give advice to people of high net worth. It's what we do for a living. We manage portfolios and give advice as to how to best do that, and sometimes give business advice at the same time. We have voicemail waiting on the weekend and real live people during the week locally at
254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
All right, and you can reach that same voicemail or live people toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. I highly recommend you go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. If you didn't get enough of this program already,
you're sick,
but we've got podcasts there waiting. If you would like to read our philosophy, sign up for our newsletter. All of that stuff is available there. You can email us directly, and we do use those at jeff@tpwc.com or Jake. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Ample Belton Killeen Fort Hood, proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News Radio 1400 KTEM.